All right, now, so today, tonight we're going to talk about would the Buddha recognize his teachings today, misconception and cultivating right understanding. I delivered the same talk in America in August this year at the American Psychological Association. You know, they have an annual convention in Denver. And it was very interesting. I'll tell you later on, some of them like what I said. You know, some of them thought I was very, very critical. But most of them agree that there's a lot of misconception, you know. So, yeah, so if some of you take objection to what I say, it's okay, don't worry, you know. I think that later on you will see that there is some evidence, you know. Maybe in the Q&A we can address that. Why myself, Charles, and a lot of people who have been doing this for a long time are very concerned about the direction that mindfulness and meditation and the Buddha are going. And so tonight's talk is just some sample. I cannot cover a lot of the problem areas, but I'm just trying to cover some areas. And they're not problem in the sense that they're bad. They're problems in the sense that there is a lot of misconception. And there is, from that point of view, a misapplication. Okay? So I'd like you to imagine two scenarios. So this is the first scenario. About 2,500 years ago, you get the Buddha, who at that time was known as Spring Sihata, you know, sitting under the Bodhi tree. By the way, this is not the Bodhi tree. This is actually the maple tree, and this is the Buddha statue in my garden. Okay, that was the closest I could get to having this one without getting a copyright and paying royalty and all that kind of stuff. Right. Anyway, as you know, that at age 29, the Buddha wanted to explore how to understand the meaning of life and the nature of human suffering. So he explored and he practiced many forms of meditation and relaxation and even ascetic practices with different teachers. And he wasn't very happy with it. You know, he fasted, he ate a lot in extreme forms. That's why then at age 38, he sat under the Bodhi tree, and he got this insight into what they call the nature and the existence, the characteristics of existence. And that's when he started to teach. Okay, and he continued to teach until he was 80 years old. Basically, he's helping people to understand the causes of suffering and how to end it. Right? It's a small question, but with a big answer. Okay, so that's 2,500 years ago. Now, imagine the scenario now. Okay? So in 2014, at a major university, a major US university, they undertook a study to develop a behavioral measure of mindfulness by asking the participants to keep track of the breathing by striking a computer key. Okay, I'll talk about this later. So you see the Buddha sitting under a tree, and now you're seeing this man sitting at a computer. Where are you guys? In terms of meditation, probably here. I hope not, but we'll see. Okay. So, but first of all, so to understand where the Buddha was and why we come to this point today, I think we have to ask a question. Would the Buddha recognize his teachings today? Right? I mean, he probably wouldn't recognize the computer, which is fair enough, or maybe as a Buddha he might. But would he recognize the way his teachings has been applied? So let us look at some common misconception of the Buddha's teachings. Okay? I can't see by my point. So the first misconception is about the true nature of existence. And then there's a misunderstanding that the concepts of acceptance, letting go and letting be, and non-attachment could actually promote being passive and indifferent. These are these are a lot of misconceptions out in the open, and mostly also in the Western countries. Okay, that meditation and mindfulness, you can operationalize it, research it, decontextualize from its Buddhist roots. And that there's another misconception that that meditation practice can be used by psychologists as a therapeutic tool without actually understanding the underlying philosophy that grounds a Buddhist approach. So this is not just, you know, among lay people. Tars has mentioned, I'm on the editorial board of Mindfulness Journal and a few others, and some of the articles that are, you know, we review a lot of the articles, they don't even mention the Dharma at all, but they can mention a lot about mindfulness. You know, it's so decontextualized. So I will be discussing this misconception throughout my talk. I'm not going to point to this, that, but it will just flow through my talk. And my talk will focus mainly on mindfulness as it's applied in research and psychology. Now, mindfulness today has gained worldwide popularity, and that generates significant excitement about its potential. Like everybody now, we've got mindful cushion, mindful food, mindful restaurant, everything. There's a lot of excitement about its potential, and at the same time, significant concerns about its misapplication. So I think to cultivate a right understanding of the Dharma, it's first important for us to understand some of the Buddha's core teachings, which we call the Dharma, and then to explore how this has been understood or misunderstood. Now, because there's often no equivalent, English equivalent of the Pali terms, I will use them interchangeably. Okay, first question, first Q&A. What are some of the Buddha's core teachings? Anybody? How many years have you been a member of Unibat?
Oh, my first year, actually.
Oh, first year, okay.
Four Noble Truths.
Okay, yeah. Four Noble Truths, yeah. What is the core teaching? He said Four Noble Truths. Yeah, the Eightfold Path is the Fourth Noble Truth, so that's part of that. But more core than that.
Five precepts?
Sorry? No, five precepts, that's not core. That's a practice. Yeah, that's not his teachings. And that practice, the five precepts, all that, comes 200 years after the Buddha died. The Buddha never thought about five precepts, eight precepts, 10 precepts. He never. The religion of Buddhism came together 200 years after he died. From a congregation in Ceylon, when they said, let's put together his teachings, because all through word of mouth. That's what I'm saying. Even at Unibat level, you all do not understand or know what the core teachings are, right? So what the Buddha essentially taught, it's not a judgment. I'm saying that so many people actually adopt the practice, right, without actually understanding what he really taught. Now, the Buddha taught that human suffering is primarily psychological, brought about by the human tendency to cling to experience, belief, and even to life, all of which are by the nature impermanent. Okay? So if we take the responsibility to actually look into the true nature of things, now by things he means everything, phenomenon, experience, sensation, feelings, our thoughts, human existence, everything, right? He says, and if we delve into the true nature of things, and apply these insights to the way we live our life, we can actually free ourselves from suffering. And understanding the true nature of things, and this is his core teachings, means understanding the three fundamental characteristics of existence. Right? Which is impermanence, anicca, that things are impermanent, that there is non-self, right, or not self, anatta, and unsatisfactoriness, dukkha. Okay? So the Four Noble Truths is that part known as in the dukkha part. So can you see why the Four Noble Truths is not his core teachings?
Right. Sorry, if I may interrupt.
Sure, of course.
I thought the three master persistence was part of the second noble, actually was the part of the first one, because the five aggregates, clinging to the five aggregates which have the three characteristics of existence, is the cause of suffering. But yes. That's my understanding.
That's fair. And that's one of the things you need to understand about the Buddha's teaching, that everything is suffering. Right? So you can talk about the five aggregates, you can talk about this thing, but what is he talking about? Why does it cause suffering? Not the clinging, not the attachment, right? I get attached to Charles cooking, that doesn't cause me suffering, right? I get attached to McDonald's, that doesn't cause me suffering.
Not having body,
okay. What he's saying, and this is very important to understand, this is his core teachings, right? If you have things that possess the quality or the characteristics of impermanence, which means that it's always changing, or it doesn't have a fixed identity, right? Then what you have as a result of that it is unsatisfactory, right? And if you cling to that, you will suffer. Can you see that the cause and effect thing, right? So if I said to you, I want to attach myself to my good meditation session, okay? And then tomorrow I get a bad one, right? If I do not understand that things change, right? Experiences, sensation all change, and that things come and go, right? And whether or not, you know me as Dr. Kong or whatever, that this is the self, I'm still a person, whatever name you call me. If I want to cling to all that, then it will create a lot of dissatisfaction. It will create suffering. So that's why he talks about, if you understand the three characteristics of existence and you know that things, that everything is impermanent and that there's no inherent self, right? And you cling to that and you don't let it go, but you experience is dukkha. Does that make sense? Right? This is very, very important. Okay, so let me elaborate on this point. Okay, now the concept of impermanence, right, anicca, points that everything, including human existence, is always in a constant state of flux. Have you ever known of a man or woman who doesn't ever die? Right. Yeah. So the Buddha says everything, including human nature, human existence, which means that everything that's formed and come together is liable to change, even mountains, even rivers, right? So there is a misconception that things are impermanent because they're discrete. You know, it's like this one, and they're all different, right? Things are impermanent from a Buddhist point of view because they are characterized by rising, passing away, and changing while standing. Now, you just take the example of human person, right? You have the child, you have the adult, it grows up older and older. The person is still there, but inside the cells change, everything changed. Even though the identity, I mean, from the time I was born to now, I must have changed thousands of times, right? So the rising and the changing, right, is what the Buddha is talking about, the impermanence of things. Now, it's very easy to see the impermanence of things at a very visual level. You know, we can see the rivers decay, the mountain decay, but the imperceptible level, the ourselves, you know, like 2 months ago I had my birthday and I thought, oh my God, you know, I look old, right? You know, suddenly. But actually we think about it, every day you're growing old, right? But then we crystallize ourselves in the point of time and say, my God, I'm old. Right? So that's why the Buddha said, if you don't accept that things are changing, on your birthday, you really suffer, right? Because you don't accept that you're ever changing. That is impermanence, is that in the nature of things, things do not last forever, and they change. So actually, impermanence is not such a good English translation for anicca. The actual good translation for anicca is transformation. So the Buddha says that everything is in a constant state of transformation, in the state of flux. Right? Because impermanence, from a Western concept, is quite scary, you know, that means you go away. He said, no, they just change, constantly change. Okay? Does that make sense? Now, if you have any questions about this, please ask me, because if you don't understand this fundamental core teaching, it's very hard to understand the Dharma. Okay? Now, so demonstrable change is very easy to see. We see seasons change, you know, we see the clock, and we see everything change, and tomorrow you got cooking, and then you eat, and then it's finished, and you go home, and they all change. But the Buddha says that it is the changes that's inside us, our mind, our feelings, our sensations, that we don't see and we don't accept and we get attached to that, our beliefs, our thinking, right? I mean, you see now in the world there's so many things that's going on, right? And people get stuck to that. And if you get stuck and you get attached to that, then you suffer when they change or when they don't change. Does that make sense? So that's how you connect impermanence to unsatisfactoriness, okay? Then the concept of anatta, non-self. Now this, the idea of anatta actually means not self. Atta is self, ana is not. So, but in the Western concept, they always say non-self. It's actually called not self, right? And what it means here, this is, anatta is actually what distinguishes Buddhist philosophy and psychology from all Eastern practices and all Western practices, right? Because it's not the soul, it's not the idea of Atman and the you know, our soul and the higher soul. It's nothing like that. The idea of not self means that there is no fixed static identity that you call the self. Okay? Like, for example, if I say I'm Belinda, right? And then you ask me, how are you feeling now? I say, oh, 8:45, yeah, nice, quite nice, you know? And then you ask me at 8:50, how you feel? Oh, starving, hungry, right? So what the Buddha is saying is this thing that we call the self is actually a process that consists of the five aggregates, right? The mind and the body. That's where the nama rupa comes in. Right, and so it consists of form, this body. It consists of feeling, whether nice or it's not nice. It consists of thoughts, sensation. So what the Buddha is saying is all this are liable to change, right? Our thoughts, our body, and our mind, and everything liable to change. So where is the self? Now that self comes from the idea that we think we have somebody actually guiding and doing this, you know. We think that, you know, when we want to do this, there's somebody actually up there, you know, directing all this, right? And that's why it causes a lot of problems when we think we can't do this or whether I'm not this and not that, right? So the idea of the self is, you know, we know that we all make up of chemistry and physics, right? Where is the self? How can physics and chemistry and water and all that be the self? It's liable to change, isn't it? It's impermanent, right? So when we cling to this idea that I'm Dr. Belinda Kong, and when I'm no longer Dr. Belinda Kong, because it's impermanent, right? I'm going to suffer because I want to be this particular person. But if I see myself as, you know, every minute, you know, my sensation will change, my feelings will change, depending on the context, right? Then I respond to the changes. Then I won't suffer. Does that make sense? Again, you can see how the idea, the teaching of anicca is tied in with unsatisfactoriness and suffering. If you don't accept that we are in the process of change, including everything that changes, then we're going to suffer when things do change. Right, when I read, then you can see some academics in my colleague, when they retire, they suffer, right? Because they're so used to this self of academic, or it could be a CEO or anything, right? Now, so if you think about this, the Buddha always gives this example, and I think some of the sanghas do that. If you take a chariot, you know a chariot in those days, you think there's a chariot. If you dismantle the chariot, can you tell which part of the chariot is the chariot? The wheels? Right? Or the horse? Or the handle? They're not, right? Until you put them together back. So the Buddha says, a person is like that. It's because we come, we got sensations and feelings and all that. You see this person because we have a form. Right? But if you take everything apart, like if you hurt and you lose your hand, do you say that you've lost yourself? No, right? You lost your arm. Is that too difficult here, understand? Right? Because we identify ourselves with parts of our body as if it is us. Right? And this is what the Buddha talked about, being attached to the belief of a static self is an illusion. Right? So like Heraclitus, who is a Greek philosopher, said that a person cannot step in the same river twice because the river is ever changing. Right? The water always comes and goes. From a Buddhist perspective, the same person cannot step in the same river twice because the person is also changing. But we can accept the water changing, we cannot accept ourselves changing. And so that's why when we grow old, you know, dukkha. Does that make sense? Yeah. So this is the second characteristic. Then you come to the third characteristic, which is the unsatisfactoriness. Okay? And this is what forms the fourth noble truth. Right? Because what the Buddha is saying is that the first noble truth is the universality of suffering. Right? That everything is unsatisfactory. Now the word suffering is a very bad translation for dukkha. A better translation for dukkha is inherent unsatisfactoriness. Because things that are impermanent, things that are changing, are inherently going to be not satisfactory because they don't last. Okay? So the Buddha talks about that there is this universality of suffering. Then there's the first noble truth. The second noble truth is that there is a cause of suffering because things are impermanent, they change, right? But there's a way to overcome that by understanding the true nature of existence and everything. And then there is a way to overcome that, and that is the Eightfold Path, which is to see things in the right way. That's why he talks about right mindfulness, right? Right speech, right thought, right understanding. He doesn't care about your understanding, right understanding of your books, right? He wants you to understand the things, see things for what they really are. And to do that, you have to experience it for yourself. Does that make sense? Okay? Can you see how the five precepts is not his core teachings, right? Or the Eightfold Path or anything. The core teaching, basically, the core teaching, this one here, unsatisfactoriness is because things are impermanent, because things are a process. So that's why, and why are they, and why is it impermanent causes suffering? Because we want to attach, because we live as if things are permanent. Right? And why is non-self a problem? Because I don't want to believe that I am growing old, that I am impermanent. Can you see? So the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha says, when you understand the three characteristics of existence, you will also understand the cause of suffering, and that will also be the end of suffering. So when you understand that things are impermanent, you accept it, no more suffering. Right? And that's why the Buddha always talks about, and you look at all the texts, they said, understanding the cause of suffering is also understanding the cessation of suffering. Right? Okay. Very simple, right? 2,500 years ago, we thought that. So let us look at what they're going to do now. Okay? So in the, now what people know is usually only this one, meditation, which in a you can see that meditation is only one part of 8 parts of the 3 characteristics of mindfulness, and one part of the 4 Noble Truths. You can see how this whole thing is decontextualized from the Buddha's teaching. But people take meditation and mindfulness as if that's all the Buddha teach. It's an, if you, I don't know, anybody can do the math, 1/8 or 1/4 or 1/3, I don't know how, whatever is that. Right? So meditation, I'll come back to that. There are 2 types of meditation practice today. Tranquility meditation, which is known as concentration meditation, samatha meditation, or insight meditation, which we know mostly as vipassana, and now they call it mindfulness practice. Okay? And meditation and mindfulness practice involve the idea of right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So in tranquility, concentration, I won't deal very much with that because you all know. It's just focusing your mind on one object, right? And trying to relax to the exclusion of other stimuli. That's why they call it one-pointedness. You focus on the breath, or you focus on the candle, or you focus on prayers, chanting, anything. There's 40 objects, okay? And the purpose of concentration meditation is to reduce conceptual and discursive thinking while you're in this state of calmness. So it's very hard to start thinking of, you know, should I go for dinner, or should I do this, or should I do that? And when you have a thought, that's why I say, whenever you have thoughts, just note them, let them go. Okay, and you bring your mind back to the focus, whatever the focus is. Hi, good evening. The second one, insight meditation, vipassana. So when the mind is calm, there is working space for the development of vipassana or insight. Okay? Now, vipassana means to clarify or to see clearly. So although the Buddha promotes tranquility meditation, which is actually in existence even before he started, he spent 8 years trying to learn different types of concentration practices. The Buddha emphasizes vipassana, insight meditation, because it is very important to understand the nature and the contents of our mind. Now the difference between concentration meditation and insight meditation is, with concentration meditation, you focus on one object and you try and reduce all the other stimuli. Now with mindfulness practice, you just watch whatever's going on in your mind. And now, I'm sure some of you are thinking, my God, I don't know what she's talking about. Right? There's a lot of internal dialogue, okay? You don't judge that it's good or bad. You're just aware that there's this whole conversation going on inside your head. And you let it be, right? You don't return it to your breath. So you're watching the nature of your mind. Is it distracted? Is it anxious? Is it worried? Is it angry? And you look at the contents of the mind. That's why they call insight. You get insight into the kind of person that you are moment by moment, and what the mind is aware of moment by moment. Do you see the difference? Right? So concentration meditation tends to focus on one object to relax. Insight meditation is just aware of everything that goes on in your mind, and you don't get attached to it. You just see, just comes another thought. Let it be. Huh. That's another thought. Let it be. Oh, that's fear. Let it be. Whatever it is, right? You turn that into a process. Instead of saying, I'm angry, you can understand that, oh, that's angry. That's judging. Right? You see whatever the mind is doing, the nature of the mind, and will lead to the contents of the mind. If you're an anxious person, the contents of your mind usually will be anxious. If you're an angry person, the contents of your mind usually is around anger, right? So mindfulness meditation lets you watch that. And the important thing is it lets you watch that in real time. Like one of my clients said to me, mindfulness practice allows to see myself reacting or responding in real time rather than from hindsight. Right? So if you're going to get angry and you see anger rising, and you go down like that, you don't have to react. But most of the time we say something and then you say, oh shoot, I shouldn't have said that. Right? Mindfulness practice, the training or the concentration practice, the discipline of that, allows you to see, oh, I'm getting angry. Maybe I shouldn't say that. Right in real time. You see the difference? Right? So meditation and mindfulness practice support each other. That's why we say the discipline of training the mind to still and calm down, it provides the scaffolding for you to be aware moment by moment what's happening to you. Right? So both of them are like what they call the two wings of a bird. Right? But the Buddha emphasizes the mindfulness part because you cannot be meditating 24/7, but you can be mindful 24/7. Right? Okay, now I don't have time. When you remind me next time, I'll talk about that more. Okay? But it's very important, and this is very important to see. This is the part that people forget. The Buddha talks about not just mindfulness. He talks about right mindfulness. And I tell you, in the Western literature and in most places, the word right is missing. Now, what does it mean? Right is not something that you judge. It's not an arbitrary stand. It's not about good or bad. Right is called sama. Sama means what frees your mind from remorse. That means you are in harmony with outside and inside. You know for yourself what frees you from remorse. Right? Like if you're supposed to be cooking tomorrow and you're not cooking, I tell you, your mind will be very remorseful. Right? But if you've already cooked and you come here, your mind is free from remorse, right? So you see, I can see from your face this one is right mindfulness. So what the Buddha is talking about is that, and he doesn't say what is right or wrong. He talks about what is skillful or non-skillful. Kusala, skillful, or akusala, unskillful, wholesome or unwholesome. Because he leaves it to the individual to judge. It's unlike most religion where they say, thou shall not do this, or thou shall do this, or this and that, right? He doesn't say that. He just said, when you feel right, when you do right action, right thoughts, right speech, right, you will free your mind from remorse. Like Ajahn Sumedho has a very nice analogy. He said, don't worry about doing right action and eightfold path and things that, you know, when I and get all these thousand merits and then the next time when I come back, I won't come back as a rat or cat or snake. He said, if you do something wrong, you go to bed, you can't sleep, right? That is already your karma. Right, don't worry about your next life. This life, this night, you can't sleep. Right? So it's about that kind of living in harmony with yourself, with or without. Right? So this, you see, the word right qualifies every one of the Eightfold Path. Right? Right understanding, right thoughts, right speech, right livelihood. Okay? Okay, now that we have this background, right? It's also very important to understand that mindfulness is a universal human capacity. Okay? There's nothing Buddhist about being mindful. Like Charles always said, right? If you're not mindful, you won't survive. You cross the road, you're not mindful, you hit the car, you're dead. So the only people who are alive and the fact that you're here, you're mindful. Right? But what it is that we are not rightfully mindful, right? What we are is we are mindful, right? With two L's. Our mind is full of junk. Everything is important. So that as a result of that, we get cognitive overload, right? And we get anxious and we don't focus on what's important. That's why the Buddha emphasized right mindfulness. Things that creates harmony, things that allows you to promote right speech and all that, not just mindfulness. And can you see why it is so wrong and a real misconception to say that the Buddha promotes mindfulness? Right? Now everybody is mindful. I'm mindful every day. I'm mindful that, you know, I got to water the plants and all that. But is it right mindfulness? Right? And that is one of the main misconceptions. Now, the other thing is that if you see the right mindfulness, right? If you're mindful, for example, that things are impermanent, right? And you get in touch with your thoughts and your feelings and you know that they're impermanent, and you actually experience for yourself that these things are in the nature of changed, into their flux, right? And you accept that. You don't suffer, right? So right mindfulness lets you see the true nature of existence, frees you from suffering, right? Because when your mind is quiet and calm, you can see that your feelings calm, your thoughts calm and all that, and you can say, yeah, you know, things come and go. And this is what exactly the Buddha is teaching, for you to experience that things come and go. And don't cling to them, don't get attached to them. Make sense? Okay. Now, so now, I think given the time, and I want to move on to Q&A, I just want to show you how or what has been done in mindfulness today. Right? But first, before I go there, just to give an example of how we cultivate right mindfulness. Right? So you take the example of anger. And the terminology they always use is right mindfulness means you pay bare attention. You don't judge it, you just watch it. Right? And you kind of see it objectively. Anger is anger. So when you see anger, then you become aware of your state of mind as an angry mind. And you see how it rises. Right? And how it disappears, right? But if you're not objective about it, you know what you do? You see the anger rising. You say, "That guy, I'm going to get him. Who parked in my space?" The nature of the mind is angry. Then you create angry contents, right? But if you can see the nature of your mind, I'm angry. Breathe. Let it go, right? Then you can see the whole circuitous nature of the mind. And there's no self, right? Because when you say, "I am angry," then you create this idea of me, mine. You know, they talk about the personal pronoun. But if you see, there's anger, which is all there is. There's anger in my mind. That's why the idea of non-self, right? When you personalize it and say, "That guy hurt me, I'm angry," then you get a lot of suffering. Because the next minute you could get more angry, or the next minute can be less angry. But if you say there's anger, and you see it rise, and if you don't get attached to it, you see it drop. Right? Same thing with everything. Right? And that's why the Buddha says, every aggregate in our body, and the form, and everything, is all liable to change, because they're impermanent. Right? And when you get attached to anything like that, you cause dukkha. You see how the Buddha's core teaching is just the three characteristics of existence. Okay? Right, let's look at our first study. So this is a study conducted in America in a very famous university. It's out, published, so I'm not maligning anybody. It's at Wisconsin Madison. Do you know University of Wisconsin Madison? It's one of the Ivy League universities. So in 2014, Levinson, who was doing his PhD and all this, his supervisors, they wanted to find out, right, can you have a behavioral measure of mindfulness? Okay, can you measure how mindful people are? Or can you have a measure like, you know, like BP, can you put a measurement and see whether your BP is high or not? So that's what they wanted to look at, a behavioral measure of mindfulness. So what they did was, they said, we've got to have an objective way of measuring it. So they have this computer. I'll go back to the slide. Okay, so they have this computer here. And they give you instructions, right? You can go online instructions, or you can have guided meditation online. And it goes, when you breathe, exhale. This is the instruction, okay? Okay, when you count your breath from 1 to 9 and again. So with the first breath, you press the down arrow key. Okay? And then you breathe out, you press the down arrow key. On the ninth breath, you press the horizontal key. That's the instruction. You go on and on and on like that. And they found that people who have more skill in breath counting is associated with more meta awareness, less mind wandering, that means they're not so ruminative, better mood, and greater non-attachment. That's what they found. Like when you can press these keys better, right? When you can do all this, your mind wanders less, you got a higher rate of mindfulness, awareness, and better mood, and greater non-attachment. Now that reminds me of an interesting anecdote. Many years ago, when my father died in Malaysia, he was buried in a cemetery called Nirvana. And you know Nirvana means the state of enlightenment. So there were signposts throughout the cemetery to Nirvana. And the Buddhist monk who conducted the service said, if only it was that simple. Right? So it's the same thing with the research. After 4 weeks, if I can tap the right key and I will have greater meta awareness, less mind wandering, better mood, and greater non-attachment, only was that simple. The Buddha spent 9 years sitting and teaching and learning this. In 4 weeks, you're going to acquire the three characteristics of existence? I don't think so. So, let me show you what happened, right, when I tried, right? So, you're supposed to do this, right? They said, okay, you got to watch your breath, you cannot do it any other way. Watch your breath, when you exhale, you know how you have the key up and down? You press down. Then you inhale. Then you exhale, press another key, second breath. Then you inhale, then you press, right? And then on your ninth breath, by which time I forgot which one is my ninth breath, right? You're going to slide a horizontal key. Okay, are you all confused? Well, I am. Because what I got instructions was, right? And I'm a long-term meditator. So what I got the comments, they will give you comments as you type. You didn't press the down arrow key on all breaths except the nine breaths. Press the down arrow key again. You took an unusual amount of time to complete the practice run. Make sure you press the down arrow key during every exhale and then press the horizontal key on your nine exhale. You know what? If they were scanning my brain, what they will see is confusion, frustration, and annoyance. What has that got to do with mindfulness? Right? And this study has been published widely, got a prize. Amazing, in America. And this one, Richard Davidson, is a very well-known person. And I'm very surprised that he actually supervised this research. Now, it's not surprising for Levinson to do this. You know why? Because he said he came up with the idea when he played video games. The Buddha spent many years sitting under the Bodhi tree trying to... He came up with it doing, you know. And so they had four studies, okay? The fourth study is to measure non-attachment. And what they did was, they asked you to play the game again, the breath and all that. And then, ping, they will give you a reward with colors, okay? And then every now and then they'll ping, and then you've got to see whether you're attracted to the colors or to the down arrow key. Those who are not attracted to the colors, which they call the attention capture, are found a greater non-attachment because you're not attached to putting your mind on to distract by the colors. Right? Amazing. So all I have to do is not be attracted to the colors and I will have greater non-attachment. You know how we all struggle to be non-attached? Right? How we struggle to understand the three characteristics of existence? Right? And in this ping, 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 ping color come up, I have greater non-attachment. Right? So this is the kind of comments I made in America. So you know. But that's okay. Now, so let me read to you, right? Let me read to you why I think this study is nonsense. Right? And it's okay, you know. Now, you know Gunatharatna, who wrote Mindfulness in Plain English? He's one of the leading mindfulness teachers. He's 90 over years old. Right, he goes everywhere, and I'm sure a lot of you have read his book, Mindfulness in Plain English. So he said here, mindfulness is not dependent on any particular circumstances, physical or otherwise. Mindfulness is just a pure noticing factor. As I said to you, it just observes everything. It is free to notice whatever comes up. Lust, hatred, or noise. So if you have this thing that goes ping, you just observe, it's a ping, right? Also, mindfulness has no fixed object of focus. It just observes change. It looks at whatever is passing through the mind and it does not characterize. Distractions and interruptions are noticed with the same amount of attention or distraction as any formal object of attention. So whether you're watching your breath or you're asking to do the down arrow key or whatever, you just look, down arrow key, right? You don't judge it as good or bad or have I got right, okay? So in a state of pure mindfulness, your attention flows with whatever changes are taking place in your mind. And the mind, if you're practicing right mindfulness, the mind is instantly aware when the shift of attention comes in, right? And the concentration drops, okay? So in other words, right, a mindful person from a Buddhist perspective would be someone who is aware of the wanderings of the mind. So I noticed that my mind is getting a bit distracted, right? Rather than somebody who is not distracted by the wandering. In other words, like when I was doing the instructions and I noticed my confusion and all that, if you're practicing mindfulness from a Buddhist perspective, you would say, confusion. You know, I would drop, right? Anger. Or whatever, I would be noticing whatever is coming up without giving them any more or less attention, right? And that would be a person who is mindful. But according to the way they tested, I am actually very unmindful because they keep telling me, you're tapping the wrong key. I was thinking of telling them, I know I'm tapping the wrong key, but I can't answer the machine, right? I'm thinking of telling them, I don't understand your instructions. But by being aware of my confusion, that is mindfulness. It's not the tapping of the right key. It's the awareness of the things that's going on in my mind as I'm interacting with whatever I'm doing. Do you see the difference? Right? Very important. Okay? So if we take into account people like Gunatharatna and all the sanghas and all the Buddhist texts and all that, you can see that Levinson is not addressing mindfulness from a Buddhist perspective, least of all, right mindfulness. Right? They're not even, to my mind, they're not even doing mindfulness, not to say right mindfulness. So are they doing maybe concentration meditation? You know, like instead of mindfulness, maybe they're doing. Well, listen to what Gunatharatna has to say. Mindfulness is a broader and larger function than concentration. It is an all-encompassing function. Concentration is exclusive, it settles down on one object and it ignores everything else. Mindfulness is inclusive. It stands back from the focus of attention and it just watches with a broad focus. And it's quick to notice any change that occurs outside, inside or whatever. Right. So with concentration you use one focus, with mindfulness you observe everything. Right. And that's why when we cross the road, we don't get knocked down because we observe the cars that pass, we observe everything, we observe our feet and all that. So, I don't think Levinson and their group are doing concentration meditation at all too. Because they're pairing the breath with the typing of the keyboard, right? In the real meditation, you just take one object and you focus. They're having multiple objects, right? Keyboard, horizontal key, exhale, inhale, be aware of this. So what I can say, to be kind, is that what they're actually testing is your skill at multi-skilling, right? Which is actually contrary to what the Buddha is trying to teach, because he tells us that we actually cannot multi-skill. We should be focusing on one object at a time, right? Now, I know that this kind of research takes a long time. There's a lot of research time involved. There's a lot of work and all that. I'm not criticizing their work. I'm criticizing their findings, right? And they have another study where they say after you do 4 weeks of this kind of thing, your mindfulness improved. Now, that is very misleading, okay? And to say that if you can tap a key, a computer key, and breathe properly, and you are higher on mindfulness than somebody who is confused, that is even more misleading. Right, you can see what the Buddha is trying to teach, right? And what mindfulness actually allows you to do, and watching the breath is what the Buddha is. There's a whole psychology behind it, right? He wants us to understand that you cannot change what has gone past, because you cannot breathe past breath, right? So what you cannot change, let it go. You cannot breathe future breath. So what you cannot, you know, modify, let it be, right? So this is the idea of letting go and letting be in a very experiential way. You can find for yourself, you can only breathe present breath, right? So you, when you do that kind of meditation and practice, you're actually experiencing for yourself about the Buddha talking about impermanence, about change, because your breath comes and goes, right? And you also understand that you have to let go of the past breath because it's gone. You cannot breathe future breath. So the Buddha's whole teaching is about trying it out for yourself. And his meditation practice, and especially the mindfulness practice, is for you to experience it for yourself. Not conceptually, not intellectualizingly, right? Just by watching your breath. So the breath has a lot of philosophy about it. And the breath, most importantly, is non-conceptual. Because if you want to, you know, sometimes you do chanting or you want to focus on flowers, sometimes you might think, oh, you know, I've been so bad, I haven't been chanting for a whole week. I create more dialogue. Whereas breath, you carry it with you, it's breathing naturally. So he does not want people to pair breathing, watching the breathing, with a lot of thoughts, with a lot of other skills. And what does Levinson do? They pair it with cognitive words, cognitive tasks, or change of colors. Exactly the very thing that the Buddha discouraged us from. Right? He's asking us to watch the breath to reduce all the internal rumblings and all that. But what they're creating, a lot of internal and intellectualizing. That's why I said the whole basis of their research is incompatible with what the Buddha is trying to teach. Okay. So that's one research. Now, anybody has any question on that? Or shall we leave it to later? Okay, I'm trying to get through, which I'm very bad because I always think I have lots of time, but actually I don't. Okay, then the next one is mindfulness. Another method is they do MRI imaging, right? And so now they want to know what happens to your brain when you meditate. So what they found was that when, and they used John Kabat-Zinn's program called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, MBSR, I'm sure you heard. It's an 8 weeks mindfulness program where you meditate for 45 minutes, you do mindful yoga, you do body scanning and all that kind of thing, right? And Charles and I went and trained in America with them. But what's interesting was the researchers said that when you do this 8 weeks of mindfulness course, right? They found that there's an increase in the gray matter in the left hippocampus up here, okay? And also in the posterior cingulate cortex and in the temporal parietal junction. Now, if you don't understand these words, it's okay. I have the same. basically, you know what they're saying, simply, is that when you do the 8 weeks of MBSR program, which consists of all the mindfulness program and meditation, you will observe changes in the brain area involved in learning, memory, emotion regulation, self-referencing, and perspective thinking. In other words, you become a gentler person, you become more grounded, you become kinder, you become less reactive, right? And they have to have this all to prove that, because the gray matter means that you are less stressed. Right? This is after the 8 weeks program, which is good.
So you mean the study says that people who practice mindfulness will have a change in their brain?
Yeah, they take a particular program, the MBSR, which is an 8 weeks program, and they scan their brain, and they found that people who do this 8 weeks program have more gray matter. The gray matter increases your learning capacity, your memory, the way you regulate your emotions, and the way you process things, right? Because you're calmer. That's okay.
Okay.
Right. Now, the interesting question I want to ask is, how do we know that these changes are related to the actual mindfulness training? And the other question is, would other type of concentration activity actually create the same gray area, like chess maybe, sports, running? Right? What I'm saying is, they have not distinguished between the actual discipline of the training, which changes the brain, or the dharma behind it, right? Like, for example, my grandson, Matthew, I used to teach him some simple meditation techniques when he was 4 years old, right? And Matthew, June, he's a very good student, right? So sometimes he said to me at night, he gets very frightened. And he said to me, "Nai, last night I had some scary thoughts." So I said, "How did you deal with it?" He said, "I took each frightening thought and I imagined I put it into a balloon. Then I tied the balloon." This is all at night, he's sleeping in his bed. "I tied the balloon to the knot and then I imagined my thoughts going away and I breathed in and out and the scary thought went away." Right? So that's what I teach him, very simple. Right. So this is 4 years old. Now Matthew is now 6 years old, and he loves to play chess, and he always, whenever Charles and I visit him, he's very opportunistic. "Grandpa, will you play with me before dinner or after dinner? Like, if he gets a chance, you can play chess the whole day." Now if I were to scan his brain now, I'm sure that I'll find his improving gray matter. But how do I know that the gray matter improvement is due to his meditative attitude, right? Or his chest activity? So I'm saying that the MRI does not tell you, they tell you what's happening, they do not tell you how it comes about, right? And I remember when I went to a conference and the Dalai Lama was there, and they all showed him very nice pictures, you know, that when you're angry, the MRI photo shows red, right? And the Dalai Lama, if you've heard this joke before, that's okay, you can pretend to laugh. Right. So they showed all this nice photo, red, you know, and yellow and all that, and the Dalai Lama said, "Pictures very nice. Why they get angry in the first place?" There's total silence. Nobody could answer that. So what I'm saying is, that's the other misconception, is that they do this at a point of time. They show you something's happening to the brain, but they do not explain to you how it gets there. That's why the Dalai Lama asked, "How he get angry in the first place? I know when he's angry, it shows up red on the scan, but why?" So the Buddha is asking you to look into yourself why you get angry. What the MRI is showing is that what comes out in your brain when you get angry. That is different from what the Buddha is saying. That's not insight meditation. That's just scanning your brain at a point of time. I'm not saying that this is not true. And Charles and I have been doing meditation a long time, so we know that probably there's changes in our brain. But what I'm saying, there's so many things that could attribute to that when they take this thing. Right? It could be he just had a good dinner. Or, you know. So there's not enough isolation.
that it is one or the other. Okay? But then for them to suggest that this program leads to this, I think is inconclusive. Like the Dalai Lama said, why they get angry in the first place? He would be asking, what is the increase? Why the increase in the gray matter? I mean, Charles and I went to America and we did the training together. Now, I'm sure there's more gray matter in my brain now. But how do I know that it's due to the 8 weeks training or just because he's nicer to me? Because he's more mindful. Do you know what I mean? It could be as a result of more or better interpersonal relationship. Right? So my point is the research are good. But to me they're inconclusive. But for them to say this and therefore this, I think is misleading. Okay? Okay. I was going to talk about something else. But I'm going to open it up to discussion. Now, you contrast this type of technical results, okay? All these things I don't even understand. I had to practice a lot of times before I could present because I couldn't even pronounce some of the technical terms. Now, I want to show you, right? Before I go that, the researchers also said that when you have this kind of changes, it's associated with increase in compassion, right? That the mindfulness meditation training are associated with increase in compassion and the cultivation of an embodied self. So you understand that you are a process, right? And all that. So in other words, what the Buddha is talking about is that when you are more meditative and more mindful and everything, you are more compassionate, right? And you refer to yourself less. In other words, you have a larger sense of yourself, right? That's what their finding was saying. Now, I find it, they go very technical to actually make it simple. Now, one of my clients, Noreen, right? She has a similar insight, right? She was seeing me for counseling and she wanted to manage her depression and she wanted some lessons in meditation and mindfulness. So I was teaching her and I asked her to keep a journal of her experience. So you listen to her journal. There seems to be two parts to my internal existence. There is the me that thinks, feels and reacts. And then there is the awareness behind all that. When there is anger, anxiety, sadness, or happiness, the awareness is neutral. Practicing mindfulness is developing my ability to reside in this natural awareness regardless of the experience of me. In other words, when she's angry or hurt, she's aware of that. But the awareness itself is neutral. The awareness is not contaminated by the anxiety or the anger. Because there's two parts, when she's calm, there's two parts. There's a part that is experiencing and the other part that is objectively watching. And this is what the Buddha talks about. You become an objective observer of your own experience without getting involved in the experience yourself, without reacting. Right? She says, I was aware that the emotion was temporary and would pass in time. Prior to my exposure to mindfulness, my internal reactions would have been very different. I would have started ruminating and made several globalizing judgments about myself, about being a failure as a human being, because I couldn't even control my emotions. And this would have started my depression spiral of which I could not think my way out. She said that the practice of mindfulness has introduced a self-compassion that I do not believe I have ever experienced before. In hindsight, I might have been emotional as a result of late pregnancy hormonal changes because she was due to give birth soon. But in that moment, with no explanation, there was compassion in that awareness. There was no judgment. Residing in awareness was full of compassion, free of stress, and ultimately peaceful. Simple, right? We can understand that. We can relate to that. That's the same result that these people got. Of which I have to read many, many times to understand that. Do you know what I mean? So the Buddha encouraged people to directly experience for themselves and talk it from a first-person experience. Right? What the research has now
objectify it, decontextualize, take it out, scan it. And so there's no more person actually experiencing the meditation. They're scanning my brain. How I feel about meditation, you don't know. And that is another criticism I have, that the meditation that is promoted by the Buddha is always a subjective personal experience. That's why when you have a meditation teacher, they always ask you, how do you feel? They never say, go measure your brain. Right? So I remember another story, right? And Richard Davidson, this is, he was telling this story where he goes to Tibet. He's part of the Mind Life Institute. He goes to Tibet and he took all this MRI machine and he wanted to measure the Tibetan monks' brain when they were meditating. And then he was saying that when he brought out all these machines, the monks were all laughing. And Davidson thought that they were laughing because the machines looked quite funny. Have you seen the machine? You wear like a cap, right? So he asked them, why are you laughing? And he said he found out the real reason later on. The monk said, you know, words to that effect, why are you measuring our brains to find out how we benefit from meditation and mindfulness? Why not just ask us? Right? Why not indeed? Like my client, she wrote, I mean, what would measuring her brain tell me about her experience? Right? So again, there's this confusion that meditation and the Buddha's teachings has to be scientific, has to be evidence-based, right? When the monks are saying the best evidence-based and the best instrument is us. We are directly experiencing it. But from a psychological point of view, from a research point of view, we cannot take your account because we think you're biased. Right? We think the machine is not biased. But like the Dalai Lama said, what does the machine tell us? You're angry, but it never tells us why you're angry, or what is the cause of your suffering, or how you end the suffering. Okay, now I'm going to stop here for a while before I go on to the next one, because I want to make sure that we have time for Q&A. Then if we have time, then I'll go on to the next section, which is about how people now try and measure mindfulness through asking you to fill in the pencil, you know. Have you ever eaten, yes or no, that kind of thing. But that is not as important as these two studies. So I want to take a break. Y'all can go and go to the loo. We'll come back in 5 minutes time, and then we can open it to Q&A, okay? Do you want to switch it off first? If you don't need to have a restroom break or whatever, I can continue, you know. It's up to you.
Okay,
so coming back to my talk, the example I'm giving you, the one about the breath counting, the behavioral measure of mindfulness, and the MRI, I'm not criticizing the research. I think that they're trying their best to do good research. But what I'm saying is that to say that what they are finding and what they're concluding is that this is a result of meditation and mindfulness, I think is a very, very strong call. Right? Because you cannot isolate what's happening in the brain. Right? To the 8 weeks program or to anything. The people who go participate in the program could go home and be nicer to the wife or the children. Right? And they're nicer back and they have less problem, and that could also contribute to the increase in their emotional regulation. Right? At least this one, we can say there's something, although we cannot tell what it is. I think the breath counting one with the computer, I think is ridiculous. Right? And to say that, give me 1 minute, yeah? To say that after 4 weeks you have greater non-attachment because you're not attracted by color, you know, I think it's a big call. Okay, so I just want you to keep in mind, I'm not criticizing the research, I'm criticizing the conclusion that they come to as a result of that research.
Yes. I was just going to say, it does sound like you are criticizing the research.
I am.
I mean, with good reason.
Yeah.
You I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
You're not trying to criticize the researchers, are you?
No, I never criticize researchers because I'm a researcher myself. And that's a good question. So the question is, I am criticizing the research, right? Although I say I'm not. What I'm criticizing is the conclusion the researchers are saying that the research shows. If they said this research shows that the better you are at breath counting, right, then the better you have attention training, that's fine, right? And the more you can press down arrow key, right arrow key after 4 weeks, your attention is more focused and you can count better and you can tap keys better. But they're talking. Their finding is that when you can tap the keys and you can count, you have better mood regulation. You have greater non-attachment. You have less mind wandering. These are the benefits of mindfulness. What they are actually measuring is just attention training. Right now, they have also got a study in there, the Robinson case, where they had long-term meditators versus novice meditators. And according to their definition, the long-term meditators are those who have been meditating more than 5 years, 3 or 4 times a week. Now, Charles and I have been meditating like 20 years every day. So according to the definition, I am a long-term meditator. But if you see the thing that they give me, the comment they give me, my mindfulness is very, very low based on their test. But if you look at what Gunantharanan is talking about, the fact that I'm aware of my constant internal dialogue and all the things, I am being mindful. So what I'm saying is that if you want to say that you are looking at a certain way of capturing attention and all that, that's fine. But to say that this measure met mindfulness as the Buddha teach, and that these are the benefits coming from tapping the key, is what I'm criticizing. Does that make sense? So there is a difference, I think, basically, between a mindful researcher and the researcher of mindfulness. And what I'm saying is, they are researchers trying to measure mindfulness. They are not mindful researchers. Yeah.
Sorry.
Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I just want to ask, in this case, can mindfulness still be an academic subject? Because these guys are trying to use quantitative measures to measure mindfulness.
Yeah.
But from what you're saying, mindfulness is something that cannot be measured. It has to be felt.
Yeah.
So
experience.
It has to be experienced. So in this case, is it still possible to research about mindfulness in the academic sense?
Okay, the question is, if mindfulness is a direct experiential practice, can you actually research it scientifically? The answer is yes and no. It depends on the tools that you use, right? So if you, nowadays they're wanting to use what they call qualitative methodology, where they actually interview the people who are doing the research, who are doing the meditation practice. And there are many interesting ways of doing it. Like one of my colleagues is doing it by, they have people sitting in the room to meditate, and then every 5 minutes, they ring a bell like in a Zen meditation, and they put a recorder there. And when the bell rings, they ask the person to talk into the microphone, to the tape recorder, how they're feeling. So they get their feeling directly, right? And they accept that the experience will be subjective. Right? So there's nobody in the room except you, and the bell ping, and then you talk. I'm actually feeling quite restless now, or whatever. And then they stop, and then they ask you to meditate. Right, they're not trying to measure it objectively, and that is the difference. A lot of the researchers, and I've got colleagues doing very good work, they accept that mindfulness practice, meditation, is a subjective experience, that you cannot objectify it like that, right? Like how many times I tap the key right, how does that measure how my mindfulness, right? That is what I'm criticizing, is there is a the methodology.
Oh, yeah. So you're criticizing the methodology.
Yeah, because you can't. It's like the Tibetan monk tell Richard Davidson, "Why are you scanning my brain? Why don't you just ask us?" Right? And so now, a lot of my colleagues in America, people like Paul Grossman and all that, they're doing very good work. He himself invented the self-report questionnaire. He himself said that this is not the way to go. The way to go is to ask people directly and take that. Like my client's account is so rich. Right? How can an MRI machine measure what she's telling me? Right? That she feels self-compassion and so on and so forth. Yeah. So, and also, the other thing is, the scientists themselves are trying to decontextualize it from its Buddhist roots. But at the same time, they call it Buddhist meditation. Then don't call it Buddhist meditation. Right? Call it something else. Right? You cannot, like non-attachment, impermanence, they are Dharma. Right? How does measuring my breath and the key, how does that help me to understand or at least look into my inside that I understand impermanence? Right? So it's very important that you understand that it's a conclusion that I'm criticizing. And the way they say this is a behavioral measure of mindfulness as taught by the Buddha. It's not. Okay, any more questions?
I'm just going to go into that a little bit. Just actually went in and read the paper while you're talking. But they actually didn't...
Multitasking. That is really bad. No, I'm serious. That's a good example. Because he's not listening to half the things I'm saying, right? Because he's not focusing. That is tapping the key. And that is actually lack of mindfulness. Thus, I'm not trying to embarrass you, but I'm saying that we do that all the time, right? We play with our friends or we play with... You know, nowadays we're all multitasking, right? I train a lot of companies, I train a lot of banks. Their biggest problem is multitasking. How many things, not how many things can I do right, how many tasks can I get on the way, right? And they're eating your food, checking email, WhatsApp, and this and that. My clients, when I see them, right? Sorry, Tas. I'll let you have your question. My clients, when they come to see me for counseling, they are writing things. I say, you know, you're wasting your money, not talking to me, not making eye contact because you're taking notes in your iPad. Right? Go home and take your notes after the counseling. Focus on the counseling first. Right? Understand? So that's what we mean about being mindful, being there when you're doing things. Yeah, what's your question?
Anyway, I was looking at the paper, like I said before, but they actually did
your Levinson paper?
To conclude
the Levinson paper?
The paper actually that was up there, yeah.
Oh, the imaging, yeah.
Yeah, the imaging one. Yeah. They actually didn't try to find any conclusion. They just said there's a correlation between X and Y, and basically it's an increase in gray matter in certain areas of the brain, and they actually... They said that they try to there's an increase in affective functions basically, but they actually didn't conclude that this leads to mindfulness. So I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yes. I think you're reading the abstract.
I'm trying to summarize myself in the abstract, but I went into the discussion.
Yeah, it's too long to discuss all that the detail, but if you read the whole paper. They were hypothesizing that mindfulness will lead to greater effect. Effective responses means your negative emotions goes down and you feel better. And they actually went and got participants from the program. So the participants that they were measuring are not just ordinary people. They measure people who have taken part in the 8 weeks program as against those who have not, what they call a control group, as against those who have not done it. And they compare their brain. And they found that those who did the 8 weeks program have shown this, and they concluded that there is a direct benefit from this. They do not say how it comes about, but they said that if you do this 8 weeks program, you will have greater effective, and you will have gray matter. That's why I said, there's nothing wrong with that. It's like the Dalai Lama said, we know there's an increase, that's good, but why the increase? So my criticism,
Buddha's teaching.
That's right. The point I'm making about this research is different from the other research. I'm saying this helps. It's very nice to see that, you know, my gray matter increased when I. But I'm saying that the Buddha wants us to get insight into why things happen, not just because they happen. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yeah.
This is more a clarification.
Uh-huh.
Seems like a lot here is really hinging on the...
Sorry? Yeah.
It seems like a lot here is hinging on the way we define mindfulness.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that, for example, in the Levinson paper, that they're operationalizing mindfulness in a way that seems at odds with how we might understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were defining mindfulness, you were talking about it as not being tied to a particular object, but being aware of whatever arises, which is something different from, say, a meditation on the breath.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at those two things, when you say mindfulness, is that more corresponding to the vipassana in that traditional distinction, as opposed to the samatha side?
Mm-hmm.
So the mindfulness you're talking about is the vipassana.
Yes, the Buddhist practice of mindfulness. You see, insight meditation consists of two factors, right? One is mindfulness, which is sati, and the other one is observation, right? So the mindfulness that the Buddha talks about is a universal capacity for all of us to be aware. Every moment, it's not a Buddhist stuff. It's not even the Buddha's finding out about it. He's just talking about our ability to be aware, to be present, right? And all that. And that is what the Buddha is teaching. And for us to increase our awareness at the right time, at the right moment. That's why right mindfulness.
So that's the right mindfulness.
Yeah, that is what the Buddha is teaching. Right? And it doesn't have to be the Buddha. The Christian teach you the same thing, Muslims, you know, anything. Right? They ask you to actually read the Bible, be aware of what God is saying and things like that. The Quran teach you the same thing. Right? And so I'm saying that what we are talking about, the idea of mindfulness, is our capacity to be aware. Like now, you are aware whether it's cold or hot and all that. The Buddha didn't give it to you. Nobody teach you to be there, right? But what the researchers are doing is trying to find out a way to measure how mindful you are according to the Buddhist definition of mindfulness.
Yeah.
Right? And actually John Kabat-Zinn has a very, he is quite, I won't quote him, but he doesn't like to be operational. People often ask him, you know, how do you operationalize mindfulness? And he says you cannot. You know, the science always wants to know how to operationalize something, right? How do you operationalize testing the breath, right? It depends on everybody's definition. It depends on what you define as the breath, right? But mindfulness is just an awareness, like my client said. Right, when she notices that when she's angry, her awareness is not angry, she's just aware that she's angry. That is just being mindful. Now how do you define that? How do you measure that? Because she could be mindful at 1 o'clock and then 2 o'clock, she could be totally mindless.
And you made the point that
that
some level of mindfulness is an everyday experience.
It is, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
Yeah. But you're also saying that what the Buddha was advocating was not just mindfulness, it was the right mindfulness.
Yes.
So can you speak a bit more to what's distinct about right mindfulness as opposed to everyday mindfulness?
No, everyday mindfulness is also right mindfulness. There's no distinction. What the Buddha is saying is that we are all mindful, right? But as I showed you in the slide, our mind is full. It's full of so many things. Right? With the two L's. What he's asking us is to be mindful, meaning to be aware of the right thing, of the right things to do, so that we are here like him. Sorry, Tas, I have to use
it. Okay.
he was being mindful to the two L's just now, right? He wasn't being mindful, right? Because he was trying to understand what I'm saying, trying to read that, trying to engage in me, trying to converse, and then pray the questions, right? Now his mind is so full of everything, you will get cognitive overload. Yeah. So what the Buddha is saying is, you can decide in this moment what is rightfully for you to be present with. Now it could be the article, that's fine, or it could be the question, that's fine, or it could be what, you know, Belinda is saying. But he's saying that for us to try and engage with everything at the same time gives us stress and gives us cognitive overload. Right. So when he talks about right mindfulness, it's not different from daily awareness. There's no like special right mindfulness, put it up in the scale, right? He says, and this is the Zen practice, when you chop wood, chop wood. Right? When you wash dishes, wash dishes. So in other words, be there. Right? So rightfulness is to be there with whatever you're doing at the time you're doing. And that's why my client says she can see herself operating in real time, not from hindsight. Make sense? That's it. Yeah. So it's not a dimensional thing, it's not developmental or hierarchical thing. Right mindfulness is just being with whatever you're doing at the time you're doing. Yeah.